So, it's a shame that Jason's not here. This is what I was talking about earlier. You know, I'll leave it on in the break, and you could see that it spins sometimes this way, and if you blink or if you concentrate on a particular area, it actually looks like it's spinning the other way. So, I'll leave it on the break, and people can have fun with that. But what I actually want to talk about instead is this. I want to talk about other uses for quantum information processing than, you know, factoring or searching or other things. And this is actually what interested me in quantum information processing in the first place, is that since the advent of quantum mechanics, we haven't, you know, been trying to make progress in understanding what it means or what it is or how to use it. And quantum information processing seems to be, you know, the next step in understanding what it's about. And finally, sort of very close to the end of my PhD, I sort of find this project, and finally I learned to stop worrying about these things, because they're going to come on their own. And I finally found a use for my quantum computer other than factoring or search or whatever else. So this work has been done in collaboration with Colm, David, and Remo. Colm from, he was a graduate student at IKC and now is a postdoc shared between IKC and MIT. David Corey is at MIT, and Remo, you met yesterday. So let me start. I'm gonna tell you about something called contextuality, and you know, you probably know about it, but in case you don't, let me start with this. We have a square grid. We're going to play this game in which in each square of the 3x3, we're going to put a value that is either plus or minus 1. And then we're going to calculate the product of the rows and the product of the columns. And then the question is going to be, if you calculate this value, the product of row 1 plus product row 2 plus product row 3 plus plus minus for the columns, then what do you get? So, you know, start by putting values in here and tell me what you get for this expression. So let's say I put all pluses and I end up multiplying, so you end up with all pluses in here. So this value would be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 minus 1, so that's 4. If you put any other value in here, I promise you, you won't get anything more than 4 or anything less than minus 4. In fact, this is the exact distribution for all possible 2 to the 9 configurations that you could have. There are about 100 in here, 100 in here, and about 300 in here. So 2 to the 9 is 512, 100, 100, and about 300 in here. So let's play this game again, but this time I'm going to put a constraint. The constraint actually comes from this equation. I want to make something bigger than 4. I'm dying to get something bigger than 4 here. So I want these to be plus 1s, and then this one, I want it to be minus 1. And in that case, I could get something bigger than 4. So, for example, if I put all pluses, and I try to find a value for this, such that this product is plus 1, but this product is minus 1, I don't know how to do it. I mean, I don't know how to do it if I am non-contextual, right? If I say, it doesn't matter what the context is, it doesn't matter if I'm multiplying this way or multiplying this way, I just want one number in here. But if I say, if I'm multiplying this way, I'll put a plus, if I'm multiplying this way, I'll put a minus, then I end up with these products that I want. And this is sort of where what contextuality means, is that I am measuring certain things, and if I want, if my theory allows me to choose the outcome of the measurement independent of the context that I'm measuring, I call that a non-contextual theory. And in the case of non-contextual theories, like you've just seen, if I constrain it, then in the case of non-contextual theory, all I get is beta less than or equal 4. But let's see what quantum mechanics does. Consider, for example, a system of 2 qubits. We're going to prepare it according to some state row. I'm not going to specify what row is for now, but we'll see what we could choose row to be later. By the way, what I'm telling you about now is something called, people know the Cauchy-Speckert theorem as sort of the Cauchy-Speckert theorem says that no non-contextual hidden variable theory can reproduce quantum mechanics. So there's this difference between quantum mechanics and non-contextual hidden variable theories. It was also discovered by Beller around the same time. Actually, the story goes that Bell wrote the paper before they did, but it sat in the drawer of some editor for a whole year before it got published. But it's essentially the same story. And this has been turned into an inequality last year by Cabillo. So that's why I call it Bell, Cauchy-Speckert, Cabillo, BKSB. So this is the story. You pick a system of 2 qubits, you prepare it according to some state, and then we're going to measure the correlations between the observables listed in the columns and in the rows of this. So you can see that in each row and in each column, the observables are commuting, are co-observable, are co-measurable. I can assign simultaneous eigenvalues to all the things in the same row or in the same column. Right? So so what you do is you prepare a state, you measure these, you measure the correlation between them, and then you put it in some in a table here. And then you prepare the same state again, you measure these, you prepare the same state again, you measure these, you measure, and then we're gonna calculate alpha, or actually we're just gonna calculate the ensemble average. So the ensemble average for the row would be something like the ensemble average. So for row one, for example, would be the ensemble average of Zi, Iz, Zz, which would be, in the quantum mechanical sense, would be just trace row Zi, Iz, Zz. And you can see from this construction in particular that if you multiply all the elements in the row, you actually end up getting the identity. Zi, Iz, Zz, you end up getting Ii, you end up getting Ii, II, minus II, because if you multiply Z by X, there's a factor of I, and then there ZXY, there's a factor of I, and two of them give you a minus sign. So it turns out that quantum mechanics actually is funny in that sense, because the correlation that you can calculate for this column will give you a minus one. So if I substitute in this equation with these values, I actually end up getting 6. For quantum mechanics. So this separation with this inequality is telling me is that not only is non-contextual hidden variable theories different from quantum mechanics, but it's actually separation. Quantum mechanics tells me 6. Any non-contextual hidden variable theory would tell me less than or equal to 4. Is everything clear so far? Yes, so again. So it turns out that this is actually independent of the quantum state.
Even from non-entangled,
this is so. So what is this number? This number is trace rho times this these operators. The product of these operators is the identity, so you end up with trace rho. So this is equal to 1. For quantum mechanics, or equal to minus 1 in this case. So you have plus 1, plus 1, plus 1, plus 1, plus 1, minus 1, it's 6, independent of rho. It's just trace rho equals 1. Yeah?
Yeah.
Right, but... That's a very good question. I tried to sweep it under the rug, but I suppose I'll have to say it now. So what I'm actually doing is this. I'm also assuming something, which is that I'm going to explain this in a second. So what I'm saying is that the product of the outcomes of the observables is equal to the outcome of the product of the observables. So the correlation is equal, the product of the operators is equal to the correlation between the outcomes. And this is allowed, as long as these commute. So Van Neumann's silly mistake, if you've heard of that, was that he did this for all operators. But if the operators are commuting, then you can actually do this. And this is precisely what I'm doing over here.
I mean, if you want to really check something about quantum mechanics,
right?
You can't say that.
Okay, so you want to cancel this line? Cancel this line. Just say for any non-contextual hidden variable theory, beta is less than or equal to 4. We'll go in the lab and we'll measure this and we'll see what we get. But if I want to assume quantum mechanics, I'm telling you quantum mechanics will give me 6. And we know the values, right? So, okay, so since I mentioned the lab, let me just mention first how to run this experiment. This is the bit that I really like about this part, is that so far we've talked about measurements, we've talked about measuring operators on 2 qubits or, you know, a 4-dimensional quantum state, but we didn't mention anything that, like, quantum information didn't really come into play. And this is where quantum information comes into play. We know how to measure operators so this is sort of reminiscent of syndrome measurement in quantum error correction, right? If I want to measure S1, instead of measuring S1 directly, I can have a probe qubit that I prepare in the plus state. I do a controlled S1 on the system that I want to measure, and that will flip the phase based on whether this is prepared in the plus eigenstate or the minus eigenstate. So if the outcome of S1 here is +1, this remains in the plus state. If the outcome is -1, then the probe qubit would flip the phase and will be in the minus state. Can people see this? Good. So if I can do this for 1, and if I do it for 2 and 3, and I without measurement in between to find out what the outcome is, then at the end here what I'm measuring is actually the product of the outcomes of S1, S2, and S3. And if I do this many, many times on the state row that I prepared, here, in this case, you know, I picked the identity state because row doesn't matter, right? We've agreed that it doesn't matter what the input state is, so I'll just prepare it in the identity state. And if I prepare the identity state many, many times, and I do this again and again and again, I end up with a measurement here of the expectation value of these correlations, right? Alternatively, what I could do is I could prepare an ensemble here. I could prepare an ensemble in the identity state, an ensemble of the probe qubit in the plus state, and I apply this once, and what I end up with here is an estimate of the correlation. Okay? And incidentally, this model of computation is known as DQC1, deterministic quantum computation with 1 clean qubit. Jean is also going to mention that in her talk. It's a very useful model, which is believed to be it's definitely not as strong as full quantum computation, but it's believed to be more, it's believed to be better than stronger than classical computation. So essentially all you need to do is just prepare 1 pure state and you're doing control unitaries here. And at the end what you're measuring here in this case will give us the correlation between the outcomes of these measurements. In other cases, it will give the trace of the unitary. Yes.
Sorry for asking.
No, it's all right. No problem.
But I do understand why you just measure 1 and 2 and 3 and then calculate those product and then.
So in this case, I was forced by my the reason I did it is that I was forced by my system. I do not have single quantum system. Right. If you did have single quantum systems, then you can just prepare this state and then do the 3 measurements back to back. Because I have an ensemble, and what I want to get here is an ensemble of the measurement of the correlation. I want to get the expectation value. Then I wanted to not do any measurement in between here. I want each one of my systems, I apply this in parallel on each one of my systems, and they all give different answers of their own, but the product of the outcomes of the 3 is the same for all my systems. So all sub-ensembles would have, maybe this one would be plus, plus, and plus, or minus, minus, and plus on the different sub-ensembles, but for overall ensemble, the product of the three is the same for all for all ensembles. I'm not really checking quantum mechanics. I mean, you could say that I'm checking whether nature has a similar behavior than quantum mechanics. Okay. But what I'm actually checking is whether my system can be explained by a contextual theory or a non-contextual theory. Okay, so the actual experiments, I've shown you the table before. So what you do is Zi, Iz, Zz for the first row, and so forth. And the reason I flashed this slide is to show you that when we do this measurement for row 1, we have to do the same exact measurement for C1. So what I end up doing here is a particular pulse to implement this unitary, I have to do the same exact pulse when I'm implementing this experiment. This is really important. Okay, so before I show you the results, let me, because this I'm supposed to be a physicist, I have to have something with a Hamiltonian in it, but ignore the big caption. I'm going to explain to you a little bit about NMR. How many people know NMR in the audience? 1, 2, 4, okay. Good. So NMR, you have, you know, atoms and they have nuclei. No, so nuclei have spin, you put them in a magnetic field, they start precessing about the magnetic field, and this precession frequency is what defines the different, you know, the different states in your Hilbert space, right? These precession frequencies is what we look at. So in this particular case, I have a malonic acid molecule. It has 4 protons, 4 oxygens, and 3 carbons. I'm ignore everything but carbons for now. These are carbon 13s, which are spin half. So I have a 3 spin half system, and this is what I'm going to be using for my 3 qubits. You can ask me later about the specific model of the Hamiltonian, but for now you just need to know that I have 3 qubits that I can design pulses on. And for these 3 qubits, if you concentrate on this spectrum for now, each set of 5 peaks corresponds to precession frequencies of each one of the carbons depending on the state of the other carbons. If you forget about the peak in the middle of each quintuplet for now, then you get these 4 peaks. For example, these 4 peaks are for one of the carbons, for C1, depending on whether C2 and Cm are both up, 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 down, down, up, or down, down. So the precession frequency of the one particular nucleus depends on the state of the adjacent nuclei. So this would be the state XII plus IXI plus IIX. And what I want to prepare, as I told you before, I want to prepare the plus state, the X state, on the first qubit, and then nothing, identity on the other ones. So this is the state that I want to prepare. I just want to prepare these 4 peaks. And then when you run the 6 experiments and you add them together in the particular, with the particular signs, you end up with this spectrum, which turns out to be around something like 80%. So the final value for beta would be 5.2 plus or minus 0.1. So if you remember the separation, it was non-contextual hidden variables at beta less than or equal 4, quantum mechanics at 6, and turns out that my particular experiment gives me 5.2. And this is all I want to say. So what I have told you is that these inequalities provides the separation and therefore is experimentally testable, and is experimentally testable using this GQC1 model, this model that is quantum information processing motivated, and we can test it on ensembles instead of just single quantum systems, which you would think if you want to test quantum mechanics, You would test it on a single quantum system, but turns out you could also test it on ensembles of nuclear spins that people diss all the time in the solid state using magnetic resonance. And like I promised, quantum information processing, I think this shows, is useful for tasks other than factoring. Thank you. Olivier?
I'm still baffled by the fact that, like, within the family, like, your medical sick, like, you're careful from the user, it doesn't matter what kind of presence of the person. Like, I don't understand, like, the fact that the calculation is just sick, but, like, from a philosophical point of view, I mean, it's also, I think that has nothing to do with the fact that that's going to contextualize me at all.
So I will say this though, when you try to violate Bell inequality, you have to pick a particular state, but you know the measurements that you're doing, right? The measurements is what decides. So here it's the same thing. It doesn't matter what the state is; it's the measurements. It's this box of observables. If you pick other observables, you perhaps will not get violation. You have to pick the right observables to observe on a state. So it's the correlation between observables that gives you the difference between non-contextual theories and quantum mechanics. So I would say it's sort of like a Heisenberg picture, as opposed to, which is actually a good thing to look at, I think. Just look at sort of the correspondence between the operators and the states in this picture and see if this would give you a state that violates. I don't really know. But it is puzzling. I mean, the reason that I actually looked at this project was that Ray came into my office one day and said, "You won't believe what I saw at this conference. You know, this guy claims that there's a state-independent test, right? So this whole state independence is not trivial." But
I wasn't at the conference or anything. Okay.
Yeah.
Everybody was assuming that when you said any state meant like any entangled
state. Right. Yeah, and I have to be honest too and say there are two other experiments that have been done, different experiments. So there was an ion trap experiment that actually appeared in Nature 2 weeks ago, where they implemented the same scheme, but their measurement was done on single quantum systems, and they did like you were suggesting, Iman, where they measured the one observable and then the second observable and then the third observable, and then they calculated the correlation by hand. Right, it was close processing. And they also get a number that is very close to 5.2. Another experiment was done on photons, but the four-dimensional system was the polarization and the position of the photon. So that's a four-dimensional system on which they did the same exact thing, and they came up with 5.2 as well. So, well, maybe not 5.2, maybe 5.4. I don't know, but 5.2. I know, but you can tell, you know, experimental results. I mean, experimental fidelity is around 90% is what you expect for, you know. So that's what you get.
All right. So I suggest you take a break. If you have more questions for Ben, I'm sure you're more than happy to answer them. I will reconvene at 4:00 for the last two questions.
it's weird, isn't it?
I don't see the other way. I can only see one way.
You know, so look away and then look back.
Always, no.
I don't know what to tell you.
I don't know what the other way means.
She's going this way, right? No?
No, she's going the other way.
See? See?
No, but just now she went this way, so
you're right. But I think that it's not completely symmetric. I mean, the other way is sort of not really correct. You can see it as an illusion. It involves some kind of jumping. You know Lubos Schmittler? Lubos Schmittler, you know? So he had a course on this, and he analyzed it the other way.
This way?
I don't know what to look at her.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I found
it.
Yeah.
So the normal one is
like that. It's
like that.
Yeah.
I can look at those.
Okay. It depends on which side you're.
Sure,
it depends on which side you think it's facing.
No, there's just
features outside. There's a shadow that's facing both ways, away from you or towards you, and that makes a difference.
If you look away for a second, start looking at her feet first, and then start looking at her head first.
Oh, I almost got the other one.
That's because you are, okay?
Yeah, try looking at it this way.
Hold on, are you making fun of us? Or
no, no, I mean, you know, you Google it. Everybody, I mean.
You like that?
Yeah, exactly. You can see that this face is back or this face is forward.
Yeah, and like, theoretically, yeah. Like this is in front, but like if you look at it, you can just like.
Yeah,
pop out,
so you can see this one is front, this one is front. That's exactly what I was saying. And in Jason's talk, the thing that was spinning,
yeah.
For it was spinning this way, but then when I pretended that it was actually like the other
it
way,
good,
it
yeah.
Started spinning because it's exactly the same thing.
But I'm really
crazy
happy about your experiment because, like I said, like when Adan is there, like in the history of like publishing papers and like some people just don't trust what he says.
Right.
And if you like, often you see like comments on their account.
Yeah.
So when you said that, like it really was like, okay, that just seems crazy because like everybody would expect entanglement to play a role in this kind of stuff.
Right.
So, but like if experimentally it works, I mean, you have to just.
And three independent experiments,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And
no,
on three different systems with three different ways of doing it, right?
And yeah, like 4 and 5.2. I mean, there's like a huge gap. So, but still, I don't know what it says about interpretation of quantum mechanics, but still, it's